Are you ready?
Yes.
Hello and welcome to the Right Dishonourable podcast, as truthful as resources permit. Jazza, how much is it going to cost me to get you to lobby for the Right Dishonourable in Parliament?
What would you want me to lobby on, Jimmy? Because generally, crooks, I mean members of Parliament, they tend to be... They tend to be employed by third parties for their expertise on how to navigate Parliament, right? What do you want to navigate?
Yeah. I suppose I'd be on the lookout for some subsidies for podcasters.
So you're looking for Department of Culture, Media and Sport stuff, right?
I think so. Yeah, I think so. Just enough that I could basically release one podcast episode a year and still have enough to get by on, I think would be an acceptable subsidy.
Great, awesome. Well, good fucking luck, considering what the BBC is going through at the moment in terms of how that's being funded. That's £20,000, please.
I don't think could I get by on £20,000? Could we get by? I mean, it would need to be per person, I think.
I agree. I was about to say, I've lived off of £20,000 before. Have you not?
Yeah, I mean, not while sort of renting in London.
Oh,
I would say
I did. Does that mean I'm better than you?
Possibly, possibly. Mm. So it was £20,000 the fee that you needed in order to lobby?
It was, because I was
okay. All right. So you're going to be pocketing £20,000 while also getting a podcasting subsidy as well.
Yes, I think we have now clearly highlighted the pitfalls of corruption.
So yeah, we are the Right Dishonourable podcast, and we meet to talk about politics, current affairs and social issues. And one of the social issues that we have been thinking about in the last couple of weeks is that of the former MP Owen Paterson,
nobody cared about 2 weeks ago, eh?
I'm sure there are a few people that still care about him, but
I'm sorry, I'm 100% sure that the people of North Shropshire had no bloody idea who he was.
that's definitely true, but he was paid all of the £100,000 a year by Randox, which ended up being awarded government contracts during the pandemic. And they're trying to work out at the moment what conversations he had with the government during this period, although for some reason the meeting minutes have been lost, which is convenient, some would say.
Oh my goodness, imagine that happening, what a coincidence.
But we're not actually going to be fixating on Paterson, disgraceful character that he is. We are going to be talking about the government's attempts to sort of protect him. The thing that started off this snowball was that Paterson was rebuked by a standards committee. He was going to be suspended for 30 days, and Boris Johnson tried to defend him and has now had to put through restrictions in Parliament, which have yet to be fully defined, on MPs having second jobs. We weren't talking about corruption or second jobs a month ago, and now that seems to be the main thing occupying Parliament at the moment. So that is one thing we're going to be talking about on this podcast.
All of Labour seem to be having a lovely time, don't they?
Yeah, I think so. I think because on balance, Tory MPs are more likely to have, I mean, they're much more likely to have second jobs than Labour MPs.
Do we know that? Is that true?
That is true. I do have some data from The Guardian backing that up.
That sounds like something that I would say and not actually know.
We can get into the weeds in the main section of the podcast, Jazza. But what else are we going to be talking about?
We are going to be talking about guten Abend, mein Schatz. Ich bin Jazza, and ich habe ein story that we're going to be talking about. It's Austria, and that was offensive. Austria is the first country to kind of to pose going back into lockdown across Europe since the winter. I believe it would have been winter lockdowns. This is the last time we had like really big lockdowns, wasn't it? There are some problems with this. So quite just a few days ago, Austria started a lockdown for the unvaccinated, which is pulls up lots of human rights stuff, doesn't it? Is that allowed? Could you do that? And Austria also has the lowest rate of vaccination in Western Europe of only 66%. So about a third of the population is unvaccinated and would have been implicated in these non-vaccine-only lockdowns. They would have still been allowed to go out and, like, jog and go shopping, though, so... Anyway,
it's not full house arrest.
It is what lockdown was like before, to be fair. But now it looks like the whole country's probably going to be descending into lockdown, so that'll be fun, won't it?
Yeah, but I think there is a brief window of opportunity for us to discuss the ethics of confining sections of a population to their houses in response to the coronavirus. And I think it does link into previous discussions we have had around things like vaccine passports to get into, you know, nightclubs or music festivals. And I guess we haven't talked all that much, I think, about anti-vax conspiracy theorists, even though it is a topic that seems to attract a lot of people's attention. I don't know that we pushed it around all that much.
We're not going to have another Brexit-style episode, like when you first just told me that you decided that you were going to vote Leave. You're not going to now tell me you're an anti-vaxxer, are you, Jimmy?
You know that I've been vaccinated.
I know, but you could have become magnetic or something.
You're right. I could have been. There are people who get vaccinated that regret it, allegedly.
Who are you saying allegedly for?
As in, I don't believe that many of those people exist. I'm sure some of them do, but it's kind of like, you know, that rule that on the internet, there's no view so crazy that you can't find at least one person advocating for it. And so,
100%. Yeah,
when people say, oh, I know people who think this, it's like, okay, well, the internet exists and there are lots of people on it. So it's very possible you do know somebody who thinks this, but does it really matter? I'm getting worked up now, so we're going to have a Brexit bust up, I think.
This is going to be so much fun. We don't even disagree. Yeah. then finally, Jimmy, were you planning on going to Leeds anytime soon? Too bad, not going to happen.
Have you been to Leeds much?
I have been. I went to Leeds to look at the university in 2006.
Ah.
It wasn't great. No. Oh. Didn't go, did I?
The city or the university?
Both.
Yeah. So you're not bothered about this story that the government is axing the HS2 connection between the East Midlands and Leeds?
I am constantly blown away that HS2, any version, the earliest version of it, will be finished by 2030. And that's just going to Birmingham. I swear to God, the Victorians did not take this long.
True, but I think the Victorians had a slightly lax approach to health and safety. So I'm not entirely sure we want to be replicating their construction standards, but I do take your point that these construction projects seem to go on for an absolute age.
I am going to be so old by the time I can actually take a high-speed train from London to anywhere other than Kent.
Yeah, that is true. But, we probably shouldn't be talking too much about your own woes, Jazza. This is supposed to be a story about the North and how it's being neglected, despite the Tories talking about levelling up all of the time.
Yeah, obviously, there's that framing in all of it that it's going to be like biting analysis.
Yes, very much so. So, I mean, it's nice that we can fail to represent another portion of the country as, you know, usually it's just people who didn't go to private school or people who aren't white or people who aren't men. But now we can fail to represent Northerners as well.
I used to live in Manchester.
I guess that counts. Possibly.
Oh no, okay. Play music.
Yep.
Beg for money. Cool. Great. Welcome to the podcast, everyone. Hello, friends. Jazza just popping in here super, super quick to let you know that we talk about Austria in this show, and the information that we provided is already out of date. We talk about the unvaccinated in Austria being subject to a specific lockdown, whereas now everybody is in lockdown in Austria. Because their graph of COVID cases is going vertically. And also, everyone is going to have to be vaccinated in the country from February next year. Changing a little bit the conversation that we had, but we still think that what we talked about in terms of the ethics of selective lockdowns of people based on their vaccine status, we still think that those conversations are lovely, juicy, and interesting. We also need to thank our beautiful, beautiful patrons. Without you, we really would not be able to keep this podcast going. You help us to manage and pay for our hosting fees and our equipment and all of those good things. Thank you sincerely to those of you that are supporting us. Nick, Jer, Alexander, David, Eterna, Andrew, Michael, Matt, and Gemma. You all are absolute babes. All right, on with the show now.
So, Jazza, in the introduction to this podcast, I revealed that I knew how many MPs had second jobs. And so I'm gonna challenge
you. Is this you? Do you want me? Oh no, am I gonna get to guess?
You are gonna get to guess.
Okay.
Bear in mind, there's 650 MPs. Just
okay. This is a great question.
Mm.
I've not actually thought about the scale of it. Just the models, you see. Mm. It can't be more than 50, so let's cut all of that out. I'm going to say 15%.
15%?
Yes. Okay. So that would be 60 plus about 90.
About 90, that's a pretty good guess.
Oh my god, am I a genius? Yes.
Yeah, it threw me a little bit that you decided to do it in percentage terms. But it's...
Sorry, don't worry, I'm also brilliant at maths.
But it's 99 MPs hold second jobs, according to The Guardian.
Oh my god, I can't believe how accurate I am. Sorry, that wasn't entertaining, I'm just blown away by my incompetence. do you think that that's a lot?
It depends what sort of job it is. So I read that, I mean, some are still kind of practicing doctors. You've got a few practicing lawyers, not least Jeffrey Cox, who's been in the news.
Yeah, and there's some of those professions, in order to keep your qualification, you have to practice a certain amount.
Yeah, that is an element of it. Some number are political advisors, or at least are classified by The Guardian that way.
That's when it gets awkward, isn't it?
Yeah, between 2 and 5 described as parliamentary advisors or political consultants. So they would be the ones who are most at risk of lobbying allegations. I think that could be said. Actually, 48 MPs also work as consultants, which is a very vague job designation. I think this information is drawn from the Register of Interests. So this is the stuff that MPs have actually declared as well. Mm.
I would assume that only an idiot wouldn't declare this stuff, because they've been able to get away with the thing about the Owen Paterson stuff was that broadly the stuff that he was doing was in the rules. It wasn't wrong for him to be using employed by these companies or get the money from these companies. Mm. All of that was above board and declared. And the same with Cox, the fact that he's earning hundreds of thousands as a lawyer and sometimes being an MP for somewhere in like south of England from the British Virgin Islands there's nothing wrong with what they've doing. The weird things about Owen Paterson, it was the fact that he was like actively going to the Food Standards Agency and the Department of International Development in order to try and wrangle contracts for them. And he used like his office. For some reason, the use of office paper and like parliament headed paper is really focused on. Yeah. And I'm like, I always find that really strange that that's something that people focus on.
I think there are specific rules about using parliamentary-headed paper. I think that's why that's always brought up. But I would kind of agree with you that if you are an MP, it doesn't really matter what stationery you're writing on.
Yeah, you've got the letters MP after your name.
Yeah, I'd have thought so. The Owen Paterson story, which did happen a little while before we recorded this, and I just could have, I was just, I don't know. I mean, I'm not someone who has a generally high opinion of politicians, although, you know, maybe it's nicer than the general public's, but I just thought once you were caught out doing something that was obviously lobbying, you would at least admit that maybe you wouldn't admit it, but you wouldn't sort of go on the record saying, oh, I've been unfairly treated here.
He literally said, I'd do it all again, I wouldn't change a thing. I mean, at least pretend to say sorry, you know? You don't need to actually be sincere.
I mean, yeah, pretend to say sorry, or at least just don't say anything. Do you know what I mean? I sort of get the people who are caught and then they just hide and then, you know, don't want to comment on the issue. I can kind of get that. But what he did was so obviously wrong. It was so obviously corrupt. Mm. For about a day...
He was given a... or what was suggested is he was given a 30-day suspension from Parliament.
Yeah.
And everybody has quite gleefully, after the amendments that the Prime Minister himself added to the bill that's going through Parliament at the moment, quite gleefully said he would have been a third through his suspension and nobody would be thinking about it.
I think when MPs are suspended, they still draw their salary as well. I don't think that's docked from them, because MPs in legal terms are roughly self-employed.
Well, how else would they make their money? Oh, wait.
But, this whole story unfolded, and I think I'm kind of... immune's the wrong word, but I sort of accept a certain level of injustice in how Parliament works. But I was like, this.
You mean to say you're jaded, Jimmy?
I'm slightly jaded, but I'm like, this guy shouldn't be an MP. This guy should be in jail. Like, yeah. he's totally, totally corrupt. It's absolutely shameful what he did. I'm starting to sound like a sort of Daily Mail columnist now.
Well, you never know, it could be in your future, Jimmy.
Could be, you know, might need the money one day in this housing market, as we've previously alluded to early in this podcast. But yeah, I mean, it's just, I don't know, in politics there's a lot of stuff that I can kind of see why somebody's arguing the other side, and I can see that, you know, there's good and bad points, but this one just seems so black and white. Basically, it just seems so stark. What he did was corrupt, and as I said, it's astonishing that what he did isn't illegal and doesn't carry, you know, a fairly severe punishment. Because that's the thing, they were saying, like, oh, we're gonna destroy the Standards Committee as part of, you know, these motions to actually acquit Paterson, who had been reprimanded by the Standards Committee. And yeah, 30 days for, like, I mean, most people would be happy not to work for 30 days in exchange for £100,000. Do you know what I mean? That seems like a pretty good deal. I mean, it should be. There was this whole thing of him because his wife had.
Well. The reason that it blew up was because he was not happy about how he was treated, and he then went on to say that it was intolerable. Poor baby. And then. The Conservatives decided to try and change the rules so that he could appeal again, I believe, is what they tried to end up doing, right? And that's when shit hit the fan. Fast forward to today, and I think it's those five MPs that you mentioned are the ones that are no longer going to be able to take political consultancy jobs. Why... I understand it to be personal connections and the fact that he was a big backer of, like, he's a hard Brexit cuckoo bananas person.
It's been a while since that phrase has been wheeled out. I've missed it.
Yeah. it's because he's a big Johnson backer, isn't it? that Johnson decided to die on this hill. And then Johnson has admittedly said that, oh, I made a bad judgment. I crashed the family car, which doesn't seem to be the kind of thing that you want to... He said that to a load of... a load of backbench MPs of the Tory party when he was talking about his misjudgment in deciding to try and change the rules for Owen Paterson, which doesn't seem like a very... It seems like a rather misguided metaphor, to be completely honest.
The quote I have here is, on a clear road, I crashed the car into a ditch. I don't know if the road was clear. I'm not sure it's a good metaphor.
That's a metaphor.
It does seem to allude to Dominic Cummings, probably not intentionally, but Dominic Cummings' frequent description of him as a trolley who just veers from side to side uncontrollably.
Brilliant. But why did Boris Johnson decide to die on this hill?
I think, as you said, the standard analysis for him defending indefensible people, I mean, the previous example that springs to mind is Priti Patel when she was... convicted's the wrong word, but a report basically said, yeah, she is a bully.
Hopefully in her future.
Yeah, well. Boris Johnson was... I mean, he was under no obligation to punish her after this finding, but he just said, okay, I read that report. I don't care for it, so nothing's going to happen. And that was just the end of that. Because I think in his role as Prime Minister, I've forgotten the particular... function or mechanism that actually led to that report, but he's the ultimate judge of what happens if somebody is found to have been bullying or something like that. This has just kind of been a rolling sore in British politics for the past decade at least and longer, is that it just really has no HR standards at all. People can kind of get away with a lot of stuff that would at least get you in some sort of trouble in most other jobs. If you know, most job contracts I've signed have some section about conflicts of interest, for instance. If you resign, there's usually a cool down period, so you can't immediately jump and work for a competitor. And in a sense, that was Owen Paterson in his role working for lobbying for a company. That company does kind of compete with Parliament in the sense that there are conflicts of interest there, and Parliament wants to come up with a fair system and fair ways of procuring.
It would
stuff.
Be like me working for Facebook, but also working for the BBC at the same time. Surely,
something like that, yeah.
Because the BBC uses Facebook to disseminate its information and stuff like that. There's clear, like, that would never be an okay combination of professional activities to have. I just can't believe how much, especially not just Conservative MPs, but how much these members of Parliament don't do their fucking job because they don't need to.
I don't think there's any obligation to do any work.
Imagine representing anywhere between 60 and 100,000 people and thinking, oh, I've got too much spare time, may as well do a bit of consultancy on the side.
Yeah, I mean, the funny thing is that a lot of people do think that MPs do have too many responsibilities when you sort of look at their case workload. And sometimes MPs are kind of described as almost like they're sort of in the social care realm, like just by or adjacent to the social care realm, because they have to do a lot of casework that actually is involved in kind of addressing flaws and problems in social care and how that's run in the UK. So there's a lot of people that say that actually MPs have too many responsibilities and should spend more time legislating and less time actually doing stuff in their constituency that probably should be in the domain of the council. I'm sure there are a lot of MPs that do work really hard. I don't think it's a particularly easy job, but then that adds to the whole sense of why are you taking second jobs if you've got so much on your plate anyway. It doesn't seem to make a great deal of sense. This is then gone back to this familiar argument where we've had quite a few times about how much MPs are paid. I think MPs are currently paid about 82 grand a year. That seems to me like it would be enough money. No,
it's so much money. It's in the top 5% of earners in the UK. I think it may be even higher.
And there's things like a second home allowance, isn't there? And there's like a staffing, and there's money for running an office as well.
The lunches in Parliament are cheap.
Yeah. I think even the pints were heavily subsidised. Maybe they still are. So I feel like financially and in terms of some of the other benefits, it seems like a relatively cushy job as it goes.
But then there is the argument, and hello, devil's advocate, how are you? Then there is the argument that some of the best and brightest in our society, such as head teachers, doctors and lawyers, aren't going to take the step down that you would need to take to leave those professions in order to become an MP. What do you say to that?
Well, I think that, I mean, maybe an economist somewhere has worked this out, but there's clearly a value to being an MP in terms of your status, which I think is a huge driver for people going into politics, broadly speaking, in terms of your ability
you say
to change.
They have egos?
To change the country in fundamental ways. All of those things could have, you know, on an individual basis, would have a monetary value in the sense that if you said to somebody, you can be an MP with this salary, or I'll pay you to do another job and I'll pay you X amount, at some point, depending on how much money that was, it would tip the scales for different people in different ways. I don't really buy it, to be honest. Like, I think that, you know, for some people, money, and particularly people who end up at the top of their fields, I think money can often be a very strong motivator, particularly as a means of keeping score after a while. I think there's just a sense that if I earn 100 grand and you earn 120 grand, you must be more important than me in some sense. And definitely if you read into bankers who earn lots of money, they do say, okay, you know, obviously I don't need this amount of money, but at some point I just like the fact that the numbers are going up, basically. So I don't know. I think you could feel...
If you get joy out of numbers going up, buy a fucking clock.
Or just, get into, video games, basically. Work on your kill death ratio on Call of Duty. Or something. Mm-hmm. There's lots of ways to enjoy numbers going up without having to earn more money.
That was a hip reference.
It was. Yeah, I was going to say Fortnite, and then I was like, that probably makes me seem a bit childish.
That does.
That would be a bit hipper in some ways. We could target the younger demographic on this podcast in that way.
Jesus.
Money is a. I think it has an effect, but I don't think you would put it this way. If you doubled the salary of MPs. I don't think you would double the quality of MPs.
I agree.
And I mean, that maybe is a bit of a flippant argument because, when you're talking about money and, raising salaries to try and get the best people, you're talking about quite incremental gains, I think, in terms of quality. But the quality of MPs is so nebulous anyway. Like, you can't really measure how good MPs are. You can talk about their attendance in Parliament and how often they vote and other stuff like that, but there's so many variables, it's very difficult to quantify how good or bad they are at their job.
I've just seen a future where I create the index.
But the index would be subjective. Like, I saw somebody had posted a list of like the best prime ministers, like an index of the best prime ministers, and it was all the measures were subjective. Basically, as they would have to be.
Well, yeah,
right?
welcome to social sciences, Jimmy, and actually most sciences. There is a human involved.
Yes, but I'm not sure. I mean, I'm sure those sort of factors do affect most social scientists, but I think there comes a point where the judgments are so subjective that you're no longer... You shouldn't be presenting that in data because it gives the impression that the numbers are, like, quantifiable in a way that they're not really. Like
But some people really like to put like a thought and effort and methodology into the listicles they make, you know.
That is true. Yeah. So the second jobs, the corruption, this has been a total clusterfuck. In theory, these new rules that have been proposed don't look particularly strong. I mean, it says here in The Guardian that they're going to affect less than 10 MPs. They do include things like restricting outside work to reasonable limits, yet to be defined. That will be defined by a cross-party committee on standards, and it also will prohibit parliamentary advice on or consultancy, which you mentioned earlier. So hopefully that will go some way to stopping lobbying, but it's definitely not a total ban on second jobs that some people
just
want.
Get rid of safe seats. So, I feel like PR is my answer to absolutely every problem, but create proportionate representation of, in some way, shape or form, that pretty much removes safe seats, and then the MP is actually going to have to do their work.
But PR would... You'd still have safe Shut seats up. In PR, wouldn't you?
Because... I'm realising, yep.
Because you'd have if you have a list and you're near the top of the list of a party that
you know is
going to
really.
Get X number of votes. But this was an argument that Jeffrey Cox made. So when they found out he'd been earning loads of money doing this legal work, he's like, oh, well, my constituents will be the ultimate arbiter of whether I've behaved properly or not. And he's in a crazy safe seat. As you said, in relation to Owen Paterson, most of Jeffrey Cox's constituents probably do not know who their MP is. And therefore the idea that you can actually be accountable in a safe seat is ridiculous. It's all a disgrace, Jazza.
I hate it.
I guess this must be what you feel like most of the time on this podcast, just emotionally exhausted.
Yeah.
All of the bad things you're having to complain about.
Exactly. Welcome to my side of the fucking argument, Jimmy.
As I usually just sit there, cool and detached, and immune to all of the bad things. This has been a good learning exercise for me, Jazza. Shall we move on to something else?
Yeah. Shall we move on to something that we're both reasonably detached from, and therefore can be cold and calculating about it? So. There has been, apparently, according to Reuters, mounting pressure on Austria's government to do another national lockdown after another couple of its provinces decided to go into regional lockdowns. I said in the intro that they were the first nation to have kind of like these styles of lockdowns again, going back in the other direction. I lied. The Netherlands have also imposed a partial lockdown for everybody. But Austria were different in that they had decided to create a lockdown for people who hadn't been vaccinated, which is about 34% of the population who are yet to be vaccinated, one of the lowest rates in Western Europe.
The vaccination rate's the lowest rather than the non-vax rate.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, that is correct. Only 66% of the population are vaccinated. Well done if you did the maths yourself. This is an opportunity for us to wax philosophical. And for us to think about, is that a moral thing? Because honestly, it gives me a bit of an icky feeling in my tum-tum.
Yeah, so we have talked, I think, a bit about the idea of giving vaccinated people, more rights.
More rights.
Yeah, the right to go into a pub or a restaurant, the right to go to a music festival or any sort of crowded indoor space. I agree with you. It does make me a little bit... uncomfortable. I can see. So the justification for why the Austrian government have done this is that they want to encourage people with a stick to get vaccinated, but they want to do it. They don't want to mandate vaccinations. So this is kind of a halfway house, I suppose.
I feel like this is worse than mandating vaccinations.
I think for anyone.
Do I? I don't know. I think they're both pretty bad. Just be better at convincing your fucking people, Austria.
Well, I think for anyone living in a... Maybe this is just true worldwide, but definitely true in a Western society. The idea of forcing medical treatment on people is very, very fraught, I think. I mean, even things like, giving children of Jehovah's Witnesses medical treatment and blood transfusions and that sort of thing. Those kind of cases are very controversial. even though in that instance, I think it's right that courts will actually force medical treatment on children against parents' wishes. But that's a whole argument about guardianship, really. But if somebody's an adult, I don't think, I think they should have basically absolute right to refuse all medical treatment. The trouble is, in this instance, for most people, getting vaccinated is not chiefly for their benefit.
It's for everybody else's benefit.
Well, for society's benefit at large, and if you're vaccinated, you do benefit, but it's kind of in an indirect way. I mean, you also benefit in the sense that you're less likely to catch COVID, or if you do catch it, it's less likely to be severe. So there are individual benefits, but I've been doing so Unheard.
Your favorite, the one with the man with the chin.
The man with the chin. In fact, the man with the chin, Freddie Sayers, did a sort of mini documentary where he went over to Austria and spoke to lots of people about this. And I found, when I was listening to the interview with the people who haven't got vaccinated, even though philosophically I can kind of, in a loose sense, see where they're coming from, I just found myself going, just get vaxxed, Just go and get jabbed. You don't have a good reason not to get jabbed. Just go get fucking jabbed. This whole argument is inane. I know it's ironic that I would say that, given that I'm always very happy to make inane devil's advocate arguments to you, Jazza, on this podcast. But if you're not somebody who thinks that, the vaccine contains like a microchip from Bill Gates, which some people do, if you're not making that argument, if you're just like, it's my body and stuff, it's like, yeah, it's your body, now go get fucking vaxxed. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's just, I get sort of arguments on points of principle, but I just can't see that the benefit of actually...
Well, maybe this will, maybe they're getting the right end of the stick then. If it is full of these people who are like, my body, my choice, and then they're like, well, you can't go... to see, what do they do in Vienna? The opera? You can't go and see the opera anymore.
I don't think that would be a significant trade-off for those people.
Do you not think so? Oh, right. You can't go and have some schnitzel. And then they actually are going to have to go and get vaxxed.
Well,
I know people who have that kind of like idea, who are like, oh, I just want to wait.
Yeah, so a couple of my friends, this was back in just after lockdown finished, were really wanted to get their vaccine so that they could go to a music festival in Europe, which required a COVID passport and all the rest of it. Part of the reason I got my vaccine, I mean, I got it pretty much as soon as I was offered it, but part of the reason I was eager to get it was because I wanted to go to a music festival.
The reason I got it was because I knew it was the right thing to do and I was saving other people who were around me.
People just dislike your party, Jazza, and you're just, your moral uptightness. People don't like that.
Yeah, but I'm going to heaven.
Well, not soon. Don't worry. Not because of dying of COVID, I don't think.
Yeah, exactly. Eventually.
I will say, I don't even know if it's really useful talking about people who just believe nuts conspiracy theories about...
I don't think it is either, because then you just get the American school system where they're having fights about whether or not their children should wear masks. And that's just a mess. How is this... How do you feel about the necessity, because we have something kind of similar here, where people will lose their jobs if they don't get vaccinated. If you work in a care home or in the medical profession, you have to get vaccinated for COVID now. The medical profession often has necessities for vaccinations anyway, actually, like for hepatitis and stuff, because they're exposed to bodily fluids a lot more. I feel less sick about that, but it's taking away somebody's livelihood. Taking away somebody's ability to go to the pub is less severe than taking away somebody's livelihood, right?
That is true. Yeah, but I think that in the case of care workers that are going to old people's homes, for instance, It's such an inherent part of the job, isn't it? And if you continue to do that job without being vaccinated, you have increased the risk of killing someone. If you're not vaccinated in general, you do increase the risk of contracting COVID and passing it on to somebody with fatal consequences. But those risks are that much higher if you're in social care or the NHS. To me, that's fair because of the nature of the job. Like if you know, me and EJ are working quite cushy office jobs, and I think if our employer said you have to get the vaccine, or you're going to sack you from your job, to me that would seem much less reasonable because it's not an inherent part of the job. Although you could, I mean, you could make similar arguments that you're putting your colleagues at risk if you refuse to get the vaccine.
Well, this is public because leaks happen at Google. We have to be vaccinated if we want to use the offices.
That seems like a fair compromise, and that's, I would say.
And that's different from country to country because there's different ability to check people's vaccination status and there's different laws. But yeah, we're not allowed into the office unless we've been vaxxed.
I mean, I'm okay with that as a compromise, although I might see that as an excuse not to get vaxxed, just so I'm not obliged to come to the office. So
yeah, right.
that could backfire. But you are, I mean, I suppose that's the thing, is that if you choose not to get vaccinated, you are creating risk for other people. That's the fundamental 100%. Problem. So it's like if somebody, you know, if somebody decides to take drugs and then they end up dying or something bad happens to them because they've taken drugs, their decision has negatively affected them. So like also affects the other people around them. So it's not as though it's totally without external problems, but it seems like a different sort of calculation, I think, than with a vaccine.
Yeah, I agree. I imagine if they were to do this in the UK, there would be like a vocal minority and then everybody else would just get vaxxed. Like maybe we're making a mountain out of a molehill here, and this is just kind of like similar to the tactics that they had in France, where they were stopping people from using certain buildings and services and stuff like that, unless you were to go and get vaccinated, because France also had a relatively slow uptake of the vaccine at the beginning of the rollout. Maybe we are just thinking about this too much, and this is just like a stick.
I think it is a stick. I mean, what somebody, again, on the kind of Unheard piece, described it as a kind of, he compared it to nudge theory. I think erroneously, because I don't think that this really qualifies as nudge theory, but...
Yeah, no, this is a pretty hefty shove, isn't
it? It's a push. I mean, yeah. that would definitely be the right physical metaphor to use in this case.
It's a kick in the balls and a slap around the face.
It's coercive, fundamentally. Mm. I mean, it's not... I think it is a way of actually forcing people to get the vaccine or making it very uncomfortable for people not to have the vaccine without actually forcing them to get the vaccine, you know, without literally dragging people from their homes and then jabbing them, which I don't think is actually so different from putting people under house arrest for not getting the vaccine, but feels very different. But there, you know, there's still massive elements of coercion in this Austrian program, but I think if the government had chosen to do it here, do something similar here, I think you're right, people initially would have protested, but I think ultimately it would have happened. I mean,
kind of like Brexit.
Yeah, similar to Brexit. Are you saying getting vaccinated is as bad as Brexit? Is that your opinion, Jazza?
Oh, I'm confused what side of which argument I'm on now.
But I mean, you remember at the start of the lockdown, and I actually thought this as well, when Italy went into lockdown, this is way back in March 2020 or February 2020, I was like, oh, that never happened in the UK. People won't wear it. And it turns out people will. People are quite happy to be, I mean, happy's putting it too strongly.
Yeah, that's doing a lot of work there, mate.
People are willing to be cooped up in their homes even if this government says it's for the good of the country. So if a Labour government gets into power, imagine what they'll be able to convince us to do.
Yeah, goodness. I sometimes think about that. Like, would we have been like New Zealand?
No, I don't think so. We're too connected to the continent, I think. New Zealand is kind of in the middle of nowhere. No offence to any New Zealanders.
Nobody goes there, to be fair. It's very pretty, though.
So I've heard.
Speaking of going nowhere and being in the middle of nowhere... We're not going to be able to go up north. Where, oh no, sorry, not my best segue.
I thought it was a pretty valiant effort, actually.
Yeah. Like you saw the strings, but I didn't quite attach them. You saw the dots, but I didn't quite attach them.
Yeah.
So, Crossrail, not Crossrail. Jesus, that's a London thing. HS2, High Speed 2, is the high speed rail that they are building between London, Birmingham, Manchester, and no longer Leeds. So it was going to fork at Birmingham and connect the north with the south. It was going to make the journey half an hour quicker. But it wasn't about the speed, it was about capacity and creating new capacity for lines, because the rail network hasn't been updated since the 1800s.
Like a lot of infrastructure in this country, to be fair.
Right, yeah. Explain to me, why, Jimmy?
So, I think it's so they don't want to spend the money, basically. HS2 is costing billions and billions, and it's been delayed umpteen times, so it's costing even more billions. And even though the government has pledged £96 billion of investment into rail in general, most of which appears to have already been announced, as far as anyone can tell, that is less than the billions that they were planning on spending anyway. So, they don't want to spend the money for some reason. So as you said, you know, HS2 in phase one is going to connect London to Birmingham, and then phase two was due to connect Birmingham to Manchester and Leeds in different places. And they've clearly decided that the Manchester line is viable or is worth spending the money on, but then the line that goes from the East Midlands Parkway, which is just south of Nottingham, up to Leeds, isn't worth spending money on. Clearly they don't feel there's enough benefit there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they've replaced this Leeds line with... they've released this document called the Integrated Rail Plan.
This is the new Integrated Rail Plan, which I think implies there was an old one somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's called the Northern Powerhouse Rail Project, which is going to be more of a cross-Pennine service that is going to reclaim some lines, but not really. It doesn't look like it's actually going to build any more. They're just going to kind of like improve the trains and how regular they are. Mm-hmm. Which, to be fair, is an absolute nightmare for that part of the world. I remember going Trans-Pennine, and stuff gets cancelled all of the time. Nothing's on time ever. Like, it's where a lot of the cliches of, oh, the trains never run on time. We're actually quite lucky in the south east. In the south and south east, stuff is relatively well managed, but it's just a nightmare up there. But it doesn't solve the problem of capacity. And nobody seems to be very... nobody who is, like, way more in the know than us seems to be very happy about it.
Well, I guess the sort of people who obsess about rail projects like this are generally very pro public transport, and they think that we should spend more time on trains, which I agree with them with, by the way. But I think it is just true that people like John Elledge, formerly of the New Statesman, talks about this quite a lot. And I think there's a general view, as you alluded to earlier in this segment, that a lot of our infrastructure is crap and decaying, and a lot of it needs to be replaced. And, you know, the fact this project's been cancelled doesn't really alleviate the need for actually replacing it. It just means that a new project will have to be announced later on, and will effectively, it's delaying, you know, solving the problem, basically. And a lot of these, like, little fixes that they've announced, like the electrification of certain lines, are things that a lot of people have said needed to be done anyway, in addition to HS2. So a lot of people have kind of criticized the government. I mean, you know, governments that make disappointing announcements like this will always try and spin them, but they've said that a lot of this saying, oh look, but we're, you know, we might not be doing that eastern leg of HS2, but we're doing this and this, is just spin, really. It's not actually really addressing the problems. And I guess from a political point of view, the Tories have spent, you know, when they've not been talking about COVID in the last 2 years, have spent a lot of time talking about levelling up in various ways. And
yeah, they've got all of these northern, like the blue wall constituencies that have voted for, have elected a Conservative MP for the first time, and promised to kind of like, to really kind of like not forget about them. This really plays into that narrative, right? Even though a lot of people, I think of all of the things, HS2 is quite an easy thing to kick because it's already down. It's already, I mean, they've barely started the bloody thing. And all we hear about is like, oh, my house will be demolished. Yeah, that's what happens.
Well, I suppose it's worth saying that there are some people, like anti-HS2 campaigners, who do live in some of the areas that would have been affected by the new line. Between Leeds and the East Midlands, who are very pleased that it's been cancelled. I don't think these are like Tory plants or whatever. There are genuine anti-HS2 activists who do.
Yeah, Jimmy, there are idiots everywhere.
I think I might have even said that earlier in this podcast. but yeah, I mean, I suppose it's also interesting coming after the weeks that the Tories have had with all the sleaze allegations, not just around Owen Paterson, but more broadly. And also the polling, which I think we're going to be discussing. You know, the fact that Labour actually, for a couple of polls, have been ahead of the Tories. There's going to be a lot of blue wall / red wall MPs, you know, Tories that were elected in 2019 from more working class areas in the north, who are probably going to be feeling more nervous about their prospects for being re-elected next time round after these kind of announcements, don't you think?
Well, they've not been in the job very long, have they?
Well, they haven't had a chance to build lucrative lobbying careers, so that's going to be disappointing for them.
Poor things.
But yeah, it seems like a pretty bad announcement. It's not clear to me why they didn't think it was worth spending the money. I mean, there's been reports that have recommended other projects, but just politically speaking, it doesn't seem like they've decided this really is the wrong thing to do, and therefore we're gonna lose the political capital, but we think this is a good decision. I mean, nothing Boris Johnson's government does seems like it's been well thought out, so maybe there's nothing particularly new there. But yeah, it all seems fodder for the Tories letting down the blue wall, which you know, people said they would when they were elected in 2019, so I suppose those people have been proven right.
Like, talking about polling, sorry, that's what the thing playing in the background was. The Independent has an autoplay. I'm unconvinced. So there was talk for a very long time about there being like a post-COVID bump for the Tories, and that seems to be fizzling. The possibility of that seems to be fizzling out, which I think actually just means that we're going to have a more time with this government, rather than them going for an election next year, for example. And I don't know. I don't think HS2 was particularly popular anyway. I love it because it's a new shiny train, and also
do you mean among the general public it wasn't that popular?
Yeah, among the public it wasn't very popular. It was and I like it because it's a big shiny train, and because high speed rail is insanely good in Asia, like across all of Asian countries, and it really transforms the way that you move around a country and how accessible different parts of the country are. And so many people in like Doddinghurst, where's Doddinghurst? so many people in Darlington are stuck in Darlington, and like having an actually good public transport network can really change people's lives in that way. But actually, really, they don't really care about that transformative thing. Like, there was a really good commentary about this on the Guardian podcast, where comparing the levelling up to agenda of Boris Johnson to the big society stuff from David Cameron, where it was just a lens through which to sell everything. but didn't actually mean anything for it itself.
I mean, the big society thing seems to me to have been thinner than levelling up. I mean, levelling up in, you know, non-political jargon terms is, I mean, it's about regional equality, isn't it? It's about mm-hmm. making London less dominant within the UK as a whole, which seems to me to be quite an important project for any government to undertake. And I mean, also in some ways that would be for the benefit of London as well, because it would mean that people who are crowding into London for various reasons could spread out a bit more, and they'd still be connected to the capital if they needed to get there for business or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But I think you're probably right. I mean, one thing that is worth noting amid this kind of story is that actually the majority of people don't take trains very much in the UK. And you could say that's partly because of the poor quality of the trains. That undoubtedly is an aspect of it. Mm. And I still think we should invest in rail. But if you don't take trains regularly, you're probably right, Jazz, that people probably will look at the story and say, well, it doesn't really affect me, so I don't care particularly. So I can see that, you know, despite all the noise it's made, and despite all of the upset from places like the Yorkshire Post, I think this will probably do the Tories less damage than it initially seems. But I also just think it would be nicer to live in a country with really good rail links, you know, affordable, speedy rail. And also it would help in terms of our environmental footprint. It would mean there was less good reason to fly from London to Edinburgh, for instance.
Mm, right.
So,
but that's not going to be finished until about 2050. And I don't think I'm even being sarcastic.
That's probably true. I think the, you know, the idea of affordable fast rail across the breadth of the UK is probably not something that me or you are going to see.
In our
lifetimes, or at least towards the end of our lifetimes. But at some point, I really should look up why it takes us so long to actually complete infrastructure projects. Because, I mean, I know that part of the reason that, say, the Chinese can do it really quickly is because they have no respect for people's rights.
Correct, yeah.
But surely there might be some better middle ground than what we're currently on. I don't know. Mm. Maybe it's impossible.
Maybe.
I think we've exhausted, this topic. It's been a very optimistic podcast. Jazza, where can they find you online if they want to communicate with you a bit more?
Jazza John on all social media platforms.
You can find me at JDE Nichols on Twitter, where I occasionally send snarky messages towards Jazza.
Yeah, twat.
Yeah, it's the main thing I use it for these days.
Okay, bye everybody.
Bye-bye.